Agriculture and Natural Resource Committee. And thank everybody for being here and ready to go. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2069, and we'll start with a short description from our administrator.
House Bill 2069 authorizes surcharges on the sale price of seed sold from the State Forest Tree Seed Bank. It also authorizes the State Forester to use funds from the bank to establish, maintain, and develop seed production areas. There is no revenue impact, maybe a fiscal impact, but the statement has not been issued.
So, with that, we'll have Sarah Lipton. Oh, Lipow. Sorry about that. Sorry, Sarah. And while we're coming up, if you have a cell phone or a BlackBerry and it's not off, please do so, because it does cause feedback. I say this every time, and it gets old after a while. But even though it's not ringing, it does give feedback to the system. Oh, and committee members, you can check yours as well. I better do that too. Okay, I did mine. Okay, Sarah.
Hi, thank you, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House Bill 2069. My name is Sarah Lebow. I'm the forest geneticist for the Department of Forestry. House Bill 2069 clarifies the legal and financial framework under which the department manages the J.E. Schroeder Seed Orchard and the Forest Tree Seed Bank. Many of you are probably unfamiliar with what a seed orchard is. It's a group of trees managed intensively for cone production. The seed orchard looks more like a hazelnut orchard or fruit orchard than an actual forest plantation. The seeds from those cones are then grown by a forest nursery, and the resulting seedlings are used for reforestation. The Department of Forestry has been operating a seed orchard complex since 1971 as a cooperative cost-sharing project with forest industry and family forest landowners. The authority to operate the seed bank is inferred from several other authorities relating to the state forest management plans, the seed bank, which I will talk about in a second, and the forest nursery. But the seed orchard has lacked an independent authority. House Bill 2069 seeks to create an independent authority to for the seed orchard in order to allow the relationships that have evolved by practice over many years to continue and for the benefits of the seed orchard to be available to a range of landowners. House Bill 2069 also expands the authority of the Forest Tree Seed Bank. The Department of Forestry operates a forest tree seed bank in order to make a variety of seed available to family forest landowners that they would have difficulty procuring directly. The emphasis is on genetically improved seed, which is seed that's produced through tree improvement research in seed orchards. These projects to produce seed are inherently long-term. The seed bank operates, as does the seed orchard, as a revolving fund that recovers costs on an annual basis. That limits the ability of the seed bank to make the long-term investments that are necessary to produce the high-quality seed needed by family forest landowners. So House Bill 2069 expands the authority of the seed bank to allow it to make those longer-term investments. It also creates a mechanism via surcharge on seed sales to raise funds that can be used for investment in tree improvement. So tree improvement is a long-term research process by which people identify, through traditional breeding methods only, fast-growing trees. At present, the Department of Forestry does not have access to the genetic material produced by tree improvement cooperatives that's of the highest value to family forest landowners in some parts of the state. So by adding a surcharge onto the seed sales, we could generate that revenue, contribute to the cooperative tree improvement programs, and therefore gain access to this high-quality material of benefit to family forest landowners. Although there, House Bill 2069 allows for a surcharge to be imposed, at present there are no plans to implement a surcharge, and one would only be implemented after full discussion with the stakeholders involved. House Bill 2069 has no fiscal impact. It allows the Department of Forestry to continue to operate the seed orchard and the seed bank as revolving funds, and ultimately, even with the expanded ability to make investments in seed production, the revolving fund of the seed bank would remain constant. So in summary, the Department of Forestry supports House Bill 2069, and I'd be happy to answer questions you might have about it.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where is the J.E. Schroeder Seed Orchard?
It's located near St. Paul.
Okay.
Near Woodland.
One more question, Mr. Chair. In Ways and Means, we had heard about a totally separate entity. I think it was called the something for sale, nursery, something or other.
The Phipps Nursery, the state nursery.
Down by Elkton?
Correct.
Yeah. Is this going to ever get in a situation like that where the market no longer really needs the state's role, and or is it even in that situation now where we figured out that the state can't really make money doing or can't even really break even doing it, and so private sector worked with the nurseries to figure out that it's handled in other ways? Are these in pretty good shape financially and useful to the community?
Yeah, in fact, the need for a state seed orchard has only gotten more important over time as the forest industry has consolidated. These are usually 30-year projects, and the state offers a stability that isn't found in the private sector. Today, I think it has 19 industrial cooperators, and 8 of those have come on in the past 3 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I actually have a question for them, but I'm senior members, and maybe Brian's senior enough now to know the answer to this, or maybe Representative McPherson or Representative Smith. If we pass this, which gives them the authority to collect the fee, at some point in the future, they're going to have to come back to the legislature to get expenditure authority. Is that not correct? Isn't that how that works? They've got to go back to Ways and Means or the E-Board to get expenditure authority for anything that they might collect. I think that's correct, isn't it?
The way I understand it.
Representative McPherson, have you been?
No, I don't know the answer to that. In fact, I have some more fundamental questions I need to have answered here.
Representative McPherson,
if I could, I'm confused. I have purchased seedlings, for example, from the state nursery in Elkton, and you get a price list, and you buy them in lots of 1,000, as I recall, when we were buying from that source. There's a price that's fixed in relation to the cost of production of running the whole facility. So why do we need statutory authority to do a surcharge, the proceeds of which to go to functions that I would have thought were part of just having the seed orchard to begin with?
The surcharge is on seed sales through the seed bank. The seed bank makes a variety of seed, including that produced at the state seed orchard, but also seed produced from lots of other places available to family forest landowners.
I beg your pardon. I didn't understand it. So it's not obviously, if it was the seed that was being sold from that operation, then you'd simply just raise the price within probably existing statutory authority. But this is applying a surcharge to seed sold that's produced elsewhere. That's why it requires statutory authority. Is that right?
Yes. And
can I ask a question?
Yes.
Let me do a clarifying. Part of this surcharge, as I understand it, is that the state would like to get into a little bit more high-tech seed growing to include some taking better genetic stock and making, more resistant trees, doing some of those other kinds of stuff that we aren't doing right now. We're just growing the fastest growing tree. We go out and find trees that grow real well. We take those and get our seed producing trees from them. But we haven't done much genetic work. Is that true?
Not exactly.
Okay.
Can I give you a concrete example?
Yeah.
Right now, the state has access to genetic material that fast growing trees for Douglas County that were produced in first-generation tree improvement programs. But we have no access to second-generation seed. So the second round of selection, you get much faster-growing trees. And we don't have any good way to fund the long-term research that's going to produce that second-generation seed. We can impose a surcharge on the sale of the seed from that same area from the first generation in order to contribute along with industry partners in production of second generation seed and therefore gain access to that seed on behalf of family forest landowners.
I'm still baffled.
It's quite a complicated
Very.
I mean,
ownership here.
Well, I mean, I'm reacting, I guess I have to confess, to the summary here. It says, authorize a surcharge on sale price of seed sold from State Forest Tree Seed Bank. So if it's the state-operated tree seed bank, why do you need more statutory authority to just raise your prices? I mean, because that's what we're talking about here, isn't it? Is you want to charge more so that you can do good things with those proceeds. Why can't you just raise the price of what you sell?
Because we have a revolving fund that must remain stable under the present authority.
If I may, right. Chair Roblin, I'm Lenny Quackenbush, the operations manager with the Private Forest Program, and I'm only here to support Sarah today. She's the expert. But this concept really came out of the existing statutory authority defines that we can only sell seed to recover costs. And the application of a surcharge is not clearly defined as a cost that we can recover. So our general counsel advised that we should seek more explicit authority to define this as a legitimate cost of operating the tree seed bank.
Representative Smith.
Well, maybe he has the answer then to Representative Oakwood's question. Do we have to come, if we give this authority, do we have to come back then to the e-board or somewhere else to implement the surcharge?
Or spend it.
Spend it.
Do you have an answer to that?
I do not.
Okay.
Answer to that.
Because I'm one of our cross-pollinators over on Natural Resources Sub, it seems to me that we're seeing both fee increase and reduction requests constantly already in there. I mean, it seems like I don't know if they have to, but they certainly are agencies are bringing these things to us to apply for grants, almost everything we're having to do.
The issue at stand is not necessarily that the increase has happened, but the ability to spend it.
Right. That's what I mean. Meaning there are fees in statute that exist, and they're coming to get expenditure limitation to just apply for grants. It's not even, and raise fees. And then if I could, Mr. Chair, just to Rose Ann McPherson's point, over on page 2 and 7, I think it really kind of lays it out, 7, 8, 9, it talks about in addition to recovering the actual costs, the state may impose a surcharge for the purpose of funding R&D. And so right now they don't feel that they can go do R&D because that's not the actual cost, but we want to get into kind of the R&D area, and the surcharge will help pay for that. And they feel right now that's not necessarily within the actual cost form.
I agree.
Yeah.
Representative Boquist.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think the question I have, and I don't think any of the witnesses can answer it, comes back to, I mean, I know for a fact that if there's two things. You must generate the revenue, and then you must have authority to spend it. So that I don't know. The real question I have is there an exemption for the state forest seed tree bank that they are a standalone entity? Because we have three or four entities in the state out there that can raise, once they have the authority, raise their own fee and spend it and are self-sustaining, so to speak. So I think before we move at a later point, we kind of need to get an answer to that so that we know what the process is and whether this would have a referral someplace else, Mr. Chair.
So Sarah, I will ask you in the meantime, after this hearing, if you could find that information and get it back to our administrator, Dr. Petrino. Okay. Thank you. Representative Mao.
So the language you chose, there's two routes, and you chose to use a surcharge, but you could have gone back and restructured the language to say you could just raise the price.
Well, it depends, purposes of R&D.
Four persons are indeed. That's the difference.
Okay. And if I could interject maybe a comment rather than a question, I think that would be the preferred way to do it. Is this really isn't a surcharge. This is just recognizing that part of the cost of running that operation is doing R&D.
Right.
I mean, that's any enterprise undertakes to do new product development, and this is in effect a state-sponsored enterprise, and it should have within its authority the opportunity to do what and expend and price itself. It's charged to its customers such that it can exercise those capabilities.
The I'll ask, yes, Representative
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I agree with Representative McPherson and Representative Maurer, but I think if you go over to page 3, what you find is you find the exception to the rule is in, and that's why I raised my question, that the money from this, if it's identified as the surcharge, then goes into a for a better word, a rolling account.
Right.
That, you know, sub-county established accounts, state forces, and money enforcers are continuously appropriated. There's the term, continuously appropriated. Therefore, don't need to come back to the legislature. And so I think that's the reason there's a surcharge, and that's why I raised the question I have.
Right. And that probably answers your question.
It answers the question, but the real question and fundamental is what Representative Maurer and Representative McPherson brought up is why are we doing it this way versus doing
right.
a biannual review?
Right.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Is he always like 5 steps ahead of everybody else and then you sort of figure it out?
2 years on revenue.
Yeah. So, any further questions of these witnesses? Do you have a clear idea of where this is going? And maybe we can call you back and ask some of those questions in the future.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so obviously.
Okay.
But that only may be this one time.
Well, Mr. Chair, then. I think a further question is because I think we heard testimony that said they were not anticipating putting a surcharge on it this time, so why would we need spending authority if there's no surcharge?
Right. Right. Well, they may need spending authority for their original fee, but not necessarily for the surcharge.
It's always fun on this committee.
Yes, it is. Jeff Stone. Maybe Jeff can answer all our questions.
Yeah. if you want to talk to me, that's your prerogative. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nursery. I'm inserting our plug here. We rank first, actually, in the nation in production of coniferous evergreens, deciduous shade trees, and deciduous flowering trees. So I'm not going to give you the billion-dollar mark this time. In January 2005, the Board of Forestry and the Legislative E-Board directed the Oregon Department of Forestry to explore details of their approach towards producing forest tree seedlings for Oregon family forest landowners that included forming a cooperative of private nurseries and leasing the state nursery. The direction was that the outcome of the work of the previous two task forces, the first was a 2003 task force that evaluated the business plan and a niche of the state nursery, and a 2004 task force co-chaired by ODF and the Oregon Association of Nurseries. These task forces and the board recognized that competition exists between the state nursery and private nurseries, and that this competition is interrelated to the broader challenge of providing a reliable and stable supply of forest tree seedlings for family forest owners. HB 2069 is the product of a solution that, in essence, eliminates the ODF's nursery operation in favor of a seed bank. This seed bank provides access to seedlings that are not currently being grown or are unique enough that the need is not being met by the private nursery owners or growers. Industry can be wary. Our industry can be wary of broadening authority of state agencies. However, we feel that ODF will be serving as a safety net in providing elevation-sensitive seeds. We feel that the partnership has emerged with ODF and feel assured that private nurseries will have adequate opportunity to buy specialized seeds. And that will conclude my testimony. I'm happy to answer any non-technical questions.
Representative Clements,
the chair. I think you helped put something in perspective for me. So on the equivalent for folks in tree fruit, you have an heirloom variety and it's not making any money, you don't, for whatever reason, you're going to get rid of it. You have one place where it's still going to survive and be around that the market says maybe not, but then someday it comes back and everybody wants that old strain. Thank you. That is very helpful. Yeah.
And I won't ask the surcharge question. I mean, obviously,
Mr. Chair, you certainly can. I just don't know if I'd be able to answer.
So the surcharge is really an attempt to give them the authority to do some of that stuff that won't necessarily make a lot of money for them, but it will keep in available some of those rare or different seeds.
Mr. Chair, I mean, you bring up a valid point. I think, especially with our nursery owners, we go far and wide throughout the world to try to find unique plant material. We have folks that we say are like the Indiana Jones of nursery stock. Having an opportunity for a state agency to reinvest through R&D and having some mechanism in which to do it, I think serves the broader need. And it gets to the point that Representative Clem made, is that may not be something that is something that our growers would want to grow right now, but having access to that seed, if it should, emerging market should come forward, then the private side should be able to participate fully.
Okay. And the other question, from my perspective, is that it's the issue that we're having right now with Port Orford cedar, the white cedar. It's dying off. We have the rust root problem, and, mm-hmm. and we see all these nice golden trees out in our forest. Hopefully there will be a time, I don't know if that's possible, when that virus could be away, and we would have good seed that we could actually, because it's such a wonderful tree, and it's not viable to plant it right now because it's not going to go very far.
Let me give one, maybe, Mr. Chair, unrelated example that may be at least tangentially relevant here. The emerald ash borer is attacking ash trees throughout the United States. Illinois, the ash tree industry itself will cease to exist. If there are ways that Department of Forestries or even nurseries in partnership with the forestry can find a ash borer resistant stock, then that's worth investing in. And so I think that the broader term that we're looking at here is we think the ODF has come a long way in working with the nursery industry, and so that's why we support this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none.
Thank you
very much. Is there anyone else here that would like to speak to House Bill 2069? Seeing none, we will close our public hearing on 2069. And just before we go on to the next one, this is why these committees are good, is that we find, and we'll get some other questions and answers, and maybe have a...
And prepare him for the referral to Ways and Means.
Yeah, prepare for the referral to Ways and Means.
I'm just glad the emerald ash borer got brought up. It was in my invasive species council thing today, and nobody asked me any questions, so I didn't get to bring it up.
We knew you prepared.
We
had a bad morning. We'll be waiting for you.
See, I didn't.
Okay. So, committee on the next bill that we have for a hearing, our representative who is going to speak can't get here. He's in a hearing for a few minutes. So we're going to move, jump over that. We'll come back to it, and we'll go to our, we'll open a work session on 2444 that abolishes the Bartlett Pear Commission.
Great. Then we have to take all our pins off.
Yes. No, we get to keep the pins.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move House Bill 2444 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith has moved House Bill 2444 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion? I always look that way, you know, right up there. Representative Flam.
Just in case, I don't know exactly how I would declare a conflict of interest. I think I may have talked about it before, but just in case, we grow, you know, several hundred thousand pounds of Bartlett's. I don't know if there's any savings or reductions. I don't think so to the growers, but just in case, maybe I should say that out loud.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, are we ready for a roll call?
Yes. Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. And a question has come. Is this one that we should think of for the consent agenda?
Mr. Chair, I so move.
Representative Boquist has moved that we put this on the consent agenda. Do I see any concern or discussion?
No, only if there's any questions, we refer them to Representative Smith.
Okay.
Right.
Then I should say the motion passed, and it will be sent to the back.
Very
good. Oh,
there you
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right on schedule. So, We'll close the hearing, the work session on 2444. And we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 2470. And as we get ready for that, we'll let our administrator give a short explanation.
Okay. House Bill 2470 would make livestock district and open range laws inapplicable to bison. The bill provides that the owner of bison are liable for damages created by trespassing animals and prohibits allowing bison to run on property of another owner.
And with us we have Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your taking your time, valuable time, to hear this particular piece of legislation today. House Bill 2470 has been brought to me by constituents who are anxious and concerned about part of Oregon's open range law. Under the open range law, you can have animals that are not necessarily behind fence, and there is a concern also that bison have become a greater and greater problem as they continue to proliferate on farms throughout Oregon. Now, these aren't wild buffalo, but there isn't any such thing as a tame buffalo either, I'd have to tell you that. So this bill is about the buffalo that roam, that need to go home and off the range. This bill would add to the overall term of animals that should not be allowed to run at large, we would go ahead and add the buffalo to those folks, the bison to those critters that shouldn't be allowed to roam at large, and there's also a concern that there the locations that are encouraging the growth of the bison business in our state. While many of those folks are very responsible people and are putting in the kinds of fences which will deter buffalo from roaming where they shouldn't go, it's becoming a very, very expensive habit to try and fix those fences too. So this particular bill, and I worked with the Department of Agriculture in some of the concerns that they've had, and they have expressed that this is becoming a problem not just in House District 60, but it's really becoming a problem throughout the state because we have various aficionados that are raising buffalo for the very excellent meat which they provide, low cholesterol meat and very flavorful meat. But the problem has become such that if you've got one or two buffalo in with your cattle operation, the fences just don't seem to slow them down. And even in an open range area, when they've gone through the fences, they become a kind of a nuisance with regard to sometimes they'll become a little what we would call a brave bravo. They become they'll charge and sometimes do some damage to other crops or to other property. So what this does is this adds bison to the animal that any animal with 50% more of the blood of a bison would be considered a bison, that property that they trespass on, the owner would be liable for that trespass or the loss of property, and that they not be allowed to roam open in a free range. Now the free range already excludes certain other animals. Oregon doesn't want feral pigs to run at large for various reasons, but they can get out of control in their breeding and create a whole new issue with regard to our environment. But the buffalo create a whole different problem. While I don't believe that we're going to have feral buffalo, I do believe that where they can be allowed to roam outside of fences as a result of the fact that they'll just walk through a fence, that creates an additional hazard to Oregonians and to private property of Oregonians. And so, again, I'm working with Mr. Roger Huffman from the Department of Agriculture on this, he felt strongly that we should probably go ahead and make this kind of a presentation in this bill today. And it came to me from a constituent, and with the hopes that maybe we'd be able to start to address the expanding herds of buffalo, the private herds of buffalo in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Boquist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Butler might not know this. Is Ag going to testify? Department of Agriculture?
Currently, no.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'm just wondering to make sure we're not, I don't think we have any ODFMW issues. We don't have any wild buffalo in Oregon, do we, that I'm aware of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, that I'm aware of, there's no wild buffalo. However, when we've had an incident where some of the buffalo were being transported to market from Harney County to Deschutes County, the gate popped open. And a number of the critters got out on the road, even at high speeds. Their height is pretty tough. And at 50 miles an hour sliding along, they become, a bison projectile. But once they get up, then they're madder than hops. And you dasn't get too close to them, and so they have to be destroyed at that point, because there aren't fences that are going to slow them down, and you got to keep them away from people and cars. And so I understood that most of the bison which got loose on a haul to the market to the slaughterhouse between Burns and Bend actually had to be shot. I think my recollection was that there was, I think Mr. Huffman told me that there were like 30 that had to be shot, because you just can't control them. And the sheriff's office, it was my county judge in Harney County that told me that they had to be shot, because there was just nothing else that can slow them down. They're just too mean. Hmm. But I don't know of anybody that's got a tame buffalo. I'm sure one's out there somewhere. But they're basically raised for their meat in this day and age, which is wonderful. And if those folks will keep them in the high enough fences and keep them back away from the public, that's wonderful for them to do that. In an open range situation, however, we've got a whole different issue, and I do have some information that there is, once they get out in an open range where livestock can be in front of the fence and they become aggressive, then you just can't. If you had a flat tire and you're out there, the buffalo could overtake you, and that's all there is to it. So the best thing is for you to do is, in some of these areas, they don't have any cell coverage, and it might be 2 or 3 hours or 2 or 3 days before somebody else comes along, and you could be stuck in your car until that critter was through with what he was going to do to your car or your pickup or other transportation, and you just can't slow them down. So I love buffalo. I love to eat the meat of buffalo. I don't want to tell you that it's a bad thing, but I'm also anxious about the effects of them roaming at large in an open range area.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a quick question, a comment first. Maybe we could turn the cougars on them. I'm just kidding.
Take a lot of cougars to get
buffalo wins.
Since they're allowed to run. What have you had any feedback from the buffalo owners themselves? Because I know people in Baker who raise buffalo who have kept them in fences, so I just wondered if you'd had any interaction with them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, the buffalo owners that are responsible buffalo owners, and I mean across the street from each other, you'll have very responsible buffalo owners who will feed their animals appropriately, who mend and take care of their fences, and mm-hmm. there's nothing like having good fences and good friends in rural Oregon. But those folks that will feed them, monitor them, take care of them, those kinds of things, they don't have the problem. It's that hobby farmer, if you will, that wants to just have one because he thinks they're just really great, and when he's got friends out from New Jersey to see the place, they look out and say, good heavens and earth, I've never seen a bison at large. Well, as long as they're behind the fence and being fed and looked after appropriately, it's not a problem. It's when they are not properly managed that we run into these difficulties, and so the bill attempts to try and bring them behind their own fence. And again, with regard to the damage that they may do, it's my understanding that probably if you can identify the owner of the bison, they probably are responsible for the damage the bison does anyway, except for the open range. And the open range issue, what we're saying is you can't keep pigs on open range, and you can't keep bison, any blooded animal with 50% more bison blood in it on open range, because they're just, it's too destructive is the response. Now, we will have folks that will come forward, I'm sure, in this process and say, wait a minute, I'm a responsible bison owner, and I keep mine penned up. At that particular point, there's really not a problem here, because as long as they're being kept and maintained and fed, they're behind fence already, and the open range isn't normally an issue. But if one were to get out, then it creates a different situation in an open range, and we're saying that that is not an appropriate critter for an open range situation.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Butler, Representative Butler. Mr. Butler, Representative Butler, how about why is the violation only a $90 fine then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know that this bill is intended to try and immediately put a serious serious weighty negative impact to those folks who have allowed or would allow bison to get out. But as we allow the Department of Agriculture to assess damage in the future, once they know that the bison should be fenced and back, particularly on open range, off of the open range, then at that particular point, I think that they can come back and help us assess the penalties that should be imposed. But for the time being, this bill was not meant to be super punitive to those folks who may have a bison that gets out from time to time.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Hey, Mr. I think I have a question that I don't think Representative Butler knows, but maybe Buck can check on it. How is this going to, we have tribal entities in the state of Oregon that I happen to know do have open range buffalo on that, and if and where we have interface between the tribal state and our state, and they cross over, how is this going to impact that, or how is it enforceable, or especially because I actually know of a problem similar to this, and it is next to one of these.
Mr. Chair, I might just respond, and I really don't know the answer to this, but I'm going to guess that it would be like one of our nine tribal sovereign tribal entities establishing that they'd like to go ahead and keep feral pigs on the open range. They can't do it under this law, so they would not be able to have, under this particular statute, wouldn't be able to have bison or 50% or greater bison blood on the open range without having them behind fence away from the public automobiles.
All right. And the difference, I think, for a lot of people is that we have designated areas in Oregon that are Oregon public lands that are designated as open range.
Mr. Chair, yes. And those areas are typically in my district in wide open areas where public lands will go for as far as you can see to the left of you, from as far as you can see to the right of you, and back and forth, and cows can walk across that area, and typically your cattle farmers will have their cattle fed and watered in various areas. They'll have their salt licks and their water in specific areas. They don't want them on the road either. But if it's in an open range area, the driver, it's my responsibility, not being a lawyer, the driver is responsible to monitor the highway, and the signs are up there to show that it's open range and that you're going to come across cattle. The one thing that you should not come across, according to this legislation, is you should not come across a bison.
Or pigs.
Yes, sir. And that's already in the law.
Yeah. And my understanding of open range is that if I were driving my car in a manner that caused injury to that cow on the open range, I am responsible for the cow.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's absolutely correct, and right now you're responsible for a bison who happens to be attacking your pickup, and that was the problem. That's the instant problem that we've got right here, is open range with an open range bison that had become very aggressive and actually had attacked a tourist's car. That's what happened. Slow down to watch it, and all of a sudden find your car had been remodeled.
So do you know if the accident happened in an open range area?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding it was in an open range area, but in this particular portion of the county where this happened, it's my understanding that everybody has fences up to the road, and so even though it's in open range, they each are responsible for their own critters. In other words, even in open range, you can get into a situation where the permits are captured by how you feed your critters behind your own fences on one side and the other. It's my understanding that this wasn't an open range area, and everyone else had their cattle and other animals back behind. Even this animal had been penned. But walked out of the pen when the feed looked greener on the other side of it, and actually charged a vehicle and became a little bit of a nuisance. That's when some of the neighbors just said, we're open range, and we're not concerned about. We know we're open range. We're going to be watching for cattle, but we sure don't want to have problems with the number of bison that are being introduced in Oregon. We don't want to have problems with those folks on the open range because they could do a lot of damage to the vehicles. And I just take a minute to imagine what it would look like to have 10,000 open range bison. Working from one side of the highway to the other.
Taking that on, though, with this particular question, when the officers or whoever shot the bison, are they responsible for giving the cost of that because it was open range to the people who owned the bison? If we don't pass this law, I would assume that they shouldn't be able to shoot them.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that the bison were loosed in that situation in an open range.
Okay.
But there would be an issue relative to that, but then when they become an absolute public nuisance, and they can't be rounded up at that particular point, Mr. Chair, I've known a number of people who have bison, and I've never known any of them that can round them up like you would cattle. I certainly can't rope them and those kinds of. I suppose if you had a bulldozer, you probably could rope them, a chain and something like that. But it isn't something that we typically can herd from one place to another quite as easily. You don't have old shelties and chefs that herd bison. They're just a different critter. That's all there is to it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing them, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have on our phone Laura Pace. I'll see if I can. How do we get?
He's going to transfer it over, and then you just push.
Hello, Laura. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, is this Laura Pace?
Yes, it is.
Well, this is the Agricultural Committee. And we're hearing the bill right now, 2470 on bison.
Right.
And so we are ready to take your testimony, and just make sure that you announce who you are, and then you can speak to the group of us.
Okay. Rob, my name is Laura Pace, and I'm an occasional tourist out in southeastern Oregon, and last year I was also employed out there for a little while. Which is how I came to hear that this bill would be coming up. Should I go ahead and say what I...
Absolutely.
Okay. The event that really caused me to want to testify about this law took place on July 20th of 2004. I was out driving around in my Toyota Tacoma on a one-lane dirt road out in Harney County, and I drove past a house or small ranch or whatever. As I was going along, I saw that there was a buffalo on the property. There is a trailer or a small house set a little ways back from the road, and then a small fenced-in field or whatever in front of it. And then as I approached, I realized that this animal was not inside the fence. It was just basically lying in the driveway close to the house, about halfway between the house and the road. I'd say maybe about 50 feet back from the road. And then as I got closer, it was lying in the driveway. It looked at me, and then it began to lurch to its feet. And I became alarmed because I had previous experience with buffaloes, and I know that these creatures are virtually unmanageable. So anyhow, as I got close to the driveway, I was going maybe 20 miles an hour. I floored the gas pedal, and I went flying past the driveway. This thing charged, and I turned and looked as I went past, you know, the head down, the horns up, the gray hairy shoulders and everything. I would say it wasn't more than 15 feet away from me as I went flying past the driveway. And as I did, out of the corner of my eye, I could see a woman in the doorway of the house, and she yelled, "Oh, my God." So, yeah, well, then I looked in my rearview mirror, and he came shooting out the driveway and then kind of trotted around in a circle and, thank God, went back into the driveway, didn't come after me. I've been out there since then a couple of times, and the creature is still out there. The other two times he was inside the fence, but both times when he saw me, he got up and was running alongside the fence next to my truck. Now, by fence, I mean three strands of barbed wire on some old juniper posts. Okay, so this is definitely a dangerous situation as far as I'm concerned. Now, the day that this happened, I just told you about, the next day I went into town. I went into Burns because I had to get a tire fixed, and I was at Les Schwab. And I told this to the guys that were fixing my tire. Well, they thought this was just so funny, you know. Ha ha. You know, they knew about this buffalo. I mean, the community is aware of this. And they told me, oh, well, it's a good thing that nothing happened to the buffalo, because that's livestock, and then you would have had to pay for the buffalo. And I said, what do you mean? I mean, this thing, if it had hit my truck, it would have rolled. And this thing is about two-thirds the size of my truck, and it was out for bear, and it would have hit on the driver's side, and there's a good chance that I would have gotten hurt. So I was pretty disturbed by the incident and also by the attitude of these people. But anyhow, that was so when I heard that this somebody was presenting a bill, I volunteered to testify, because these animals are not like cows. I come from central New York, and now that's not an area that you ordinarily associate with buffalo. But it was a farming area, and there was a man out there who owned a restaurant and had a herd of about 80 buffalo. And the rest of the surrounding area was dairy farmers. Now, periodically, the buffalo would just go for a stroll. I mean, the farmer said if they really wanted to get out, there was no way to keep them in. They would go out, and they would be out there for days before they were finally persuaded in some manner to return home. They would trample on fields, they would break into barns and knock over fences, and the dairy farmers in the area were very much up in arms about the herd of buffalo that just would kind of go out and do what they did when they felt like it. So that's my previous experience with buffalo before this incident of being charged. Well, let me say, it was really rather alarming, and I just think these creatures need to be treated like the somewhat dangerous things that they are, and that the owner has to be responsible for, I mean, it was just lying in the driveway. You know, you can't, anyhow. That's what I have to say about it.
Well, thank you. We'll see if there are some questions here of any of our members. Any questions for this witness? Seeing none, I want to thank you for taking your time to testify.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity. I feel good. At least I have a chance to try to do something about this. Because in that area out there, they're trying to encourage tourism. You know, Steens Mountain and Albert Lake and the whole area. And believe me, you know, if you get a tourist from Portland or somebody going out there, you know, you don't want to have these creatures. Cows aren't the same. You can drive past a herd of cows, and even if they're out on the road, if you go slowly, nothing will happen. That's not the same thing at all. These creatures are not amenable to that kind of thing. They are dangerous. They are unruly, and they're unstoppable once they get going. So,
well, thank you again very much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. Take care. Bye bye.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think for the record, that must have been a watch bison.
Yeah. Okay, next we have Jim Walsh.
This is unbelievable.
Walsh.
With a little hat just laying there like a dog and just hop up.
That's
true.
Watch.
Chair Roblin, yes. Committee members, Jim Walsh with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. And we just wanted to weigh in a little bit on this. And at this point in time, as you see indicated on the sign-in sheet there, we are for this piece of legislation, and it's just kind of with some reservation, but that's only because we have some of our members are do raise some bison or beefalo. And in fact, a good friend of mine has in Lane County, just outside of Eugene, just on the east side of the Fern Ridge Reservoir, has a very large ranch there raising bison and beefalo. And he has some very stout fences. There's no doubt about it. He does. Within the legislation, I think there's something that may need to be corrected here. And maybe I could call Roger Huffman up with the ODA, and we could kind of clarify a little bit around the issue of open range here, because it does include private state land and federal land, not just strictly federal land.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that to clarify a little bit more
first
on
first
that.
First, you have to your name.
Oh, excuse me. I'm Roger Huffman, program manager for livestock ID staff at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. There's many, many events, got lots of articles of escapes and those kind of issues with the buffalo, and it's true that getting them back in or getting them all back in is nearly impossible, so they usually have to harvest the ones that aren't manageable. So it depends on the time of year. Sometimes you can lead them back in with food. But the issue with open range, a couple of things, I guess, to go along with Representative Butler's testimony is that one of the key things about open range is the law says that the animals that are defined in that statute have the right to be there wherever they are unless there's an adequate fence to keep them out. So the issue is in the definition, which is being proposed to be changed here, is the part that says animals of the bovine species is being removed and cattle is being put in its place, because that has been the confusing part of this on the open range and with the sheriff and law enforcement is even though bison is of the bovidae family, it's not under the state vet's opinion that bovine species, but nevertheless a lot of lay people would just say, yes, it does apply, so therefore it's open range and my buffalo can be out there. And if you don't want it to come on you, you have to build a buffalo-proof fence. This will clarify that that's not the case. If you want to have buffalo and you want to have them out there and have this as a thing, just as if you want to have pigeons running loose on your place, you're responsible for everything they do if they get off, and it's not the other party's responsibility to fence them out. That's what open range is all about. And so I wanted to clarify that little piece.
So the question I have is that you're saying that there are three, open range is a whole area. It may have federal lands, it may have state lands, it may have private lands. What this does is it doesn't matter on any of those. It's the responsibility of the owner to keep their bison in.
Mr. Chair, correct. It clarifies that it is a responsibility, and it also clearly says it's not the responsibility of the other party.
And one other question then. Oftentimes, a lot of the federal land, they lease for people to put their cattle on and so on. That would not be available for bison unless they put a fence on that?
Chair Roblin, that the federal land is I guess, quasi-open range. They have their own trespassing laws. The state law, they don't apply when there are animals that don't have a permit on there. I do not know of any time where they've ever allowed buffalo on the public lands to be permitted
Okay. And do you possibly have an answer to Representative Boquist's question with regard to the Native American issue and their open range policy that they may have?
Chair Roland, yes, Representative Boquist. There, because it was essentially answered correctly that it is a sovereign nation and it has its closed range per Oregon law. It's just when they step off of that onto the land, then we have to, and it's our responsibility, the Department of Ag, to keep maps of every county of where open range is and what it is. And it depends on, it doesn't matter whether there's a fence or there or not. It matters what the ground is that they step onto, is whether it's closed or open range, as to how things. If it's closed range, it's already the responsibility of those livestock owners to take care of their stuff. So we don't know.
Representative Boquist.
Follow up to say, just clarify, I am correct, it's basically federal property. And so, therefore, our rule or our law doesn't apply to them, but then once that critter steps across, it does. And that's the interface, the legal interface okay. I was talking about, which I think is slightly more complex and just a matter of clarifying so we know going into this what it is.
Yes.
So, the issue that you have with the language here, is there a problem with the language?
Chair Roblin, committee members, under Section 2, Sub 1 there, as used in this section, bison means an animal that is at least 50% bison by blood. And how are we going to determine that? And so after talking with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, with Roger and I talked about it, we thought maybe we should get this amended, and it would be a bivisual ID. Because we can tell when they have crossed, when there's when it's beefalo, it's pretty obvious. When you've got bison that have crossed with other cattle, it's obvious. I think determining it visually would be much easier and much less costly.
So. Chair Roblin, essentially that sums it up. The beefalo is by registrability has to be 37% or less buffalo, and so it can be much less than that. And they don't resemble a buffalo generally. They may have a little bit of a hump, but generally they'll look like a beef breed. But if it's a 50-50 cross, they will look like a buffalo. And the only place that we could find that did research, there is a place in Australia that does the DNA research to prove whether it's a beefalo or not. But that's the expensive side of it if you have to go with the DNA testing.
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Welsh, is there, to your knowledge, is there anyone who is running herds of bison on open range land in Oregon now?
Chair Melbourne, Representative McPherson, no. I don't know of anybody that is. Roger would know better than I if they are. I don't know of anybody.
Chair Roland, Representative McPherson, most of them, if you take the numbers, most of them are on open range. If you take the counties on the east side, primarily all the land in a county is an open range designation except for the incorporated town itself. So if it's out of the city limits in any most of those eastern Oregon counties, it's open range, and that's where they are being. And where this derived from was clearly 30, 40 miles out of Burns. And like Wallowa County, for example, just 2 miles north out the North Highway, you're going to see 300-400 of them on either side of the highway there. And that's all open range. It looks urban. It's in the valley bottom and everything, but it is open range by law.
If I could follow up on that. So it sounds like technically that's all open range land, but there's, maybe I'm looking for a practical answer, which is anyone raising herds of bison with the intention of letting them run at large across what we think of as open range land, or are they in fact attempting to fence in their stock as they're currently growing them?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, generally I would say no. The case in Umatilla County in 2003 where 62 buffalo were out running around at large for months was a situation where the property owner was evicted from the land, didn't have anything that they could see as an alternative, and they let, at least the appears that they let the buffalo loose, partially because they were upset at the local authorities, and partially because the market, you know, it's like anything. There's, if it's a breeder's market, they're worth a lot, and at that particular time, they were worth basically beef prices. And so in that case, you've got a situation where they were allowed to run at large, and nobody knew. They ended up getting some elk fences that they catch elk in and baiting in, and when they got done, there was 30 that was they got back. 32 of them were killed, and the sheriff told everybody they're welcome to kill them because there wasn't anything they could do. And they were out there for months tearing fences and marauding, I guess the paper said.
And in that particular case, and in the case now without this law, the people would have no recourse towards that owner of that because it's open range, and they weren't listed as one of those non-open range species. So there was no recourse with respect to going back at that owner for those cattle, for those beef, was there? I mean, the buffalo?
Representative Roblin, essentially that's it. It was unclear whether the open range applied or not because of this fuzzy definition by the sheriff and the whole situation. The sheriff just said, okay, doesn't appear there's anything that applies or that covers here, and we don't really have a good grip on what to do. So he just said, told people, harvest them. And he was fine with that. And he, even though we're private property, that's what happened.
Okay. Representative Bumper.
Mr. Chair, yeah, just for the record, the case in Wallowa County, that's a very well-managed buffalo operation, which is well-fenced on both sides and has been there for quite a while. Because, I mean, when the market's good, this is a very high-dollar piece of livestock, so to speak, or whatever you want to call it. But it does raise the question, as Representative McPherson pointed out, you know, is there none roaming free? And the places that would have the legal right to roam free would, of course, be the tribes. Or, having said that, the federal government does, in fact, manage herds on various properties around the country, not here in the United States at this point, but it's not endangered yet, and that's why I kind of raised the issue of jurisdiction.
Chair Roblin, there is, down that line, I guess the one added statement in Wallowa County at Water Creek is separate, not the same entity that he and I were talking about. In the same year, 2003, there was about 21 got out from an enclosure, and they couldn't get six of them back, and they did move up into the federal lands and up close to the wilderness, and an archer hunter harvested one and actually went in after the fact and wanted to get a buffalo tag from ODFW because everybody thought they must be wild since they were so far away from the housing and up in public lands.
They take his money, Mr. Chair.
Okay. To proceed, I guess we could have that amendment drafted. Mm-hmm. So, and I'll talk to Representative Butler about that too. Any other testimony? Any questions? Then we will close our hearing on 2470. Thank you both for your testimony. It's always interesting what we have the opportunity to deal with. Okay, now we will open a work session on House Bill 2445.
2445 is the bill that amends the definition of charge in the statutes which provide liability immunity to landowners who allow access onto their property. The definition is amended so that it does not include any amount received from a public body in return for granting that permission for the public to go upon the owner's land. There is no revenue or fiscal impact, and the bill does not have a subsequent referral.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Smith.
I move House Bill 2445 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2445 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Great bill.
Seeing none, we'll have our roll call.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Chair Robles?
Aye. So we received our constitutionally necessary majority. I don't know that this is one that we should necessarily go to.
I think Representative Clem would like to carry.
That's what I was wondering.
Grayville.
Okay. That's what I was. So we will assign Representative Clem to carry this bill. We'll get some of it.
Yeah, Speaker, Grayville should pass. Right. Thank you, incidental.
Okay. So we will assign Representative Clem. Okay. Any other business or issues? We'll close our hearing on 2445. Any other business to come before the committee that anyone has? Then we will close our committee on Ag and Natural Resources. Thank you very much.